Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is Donald Trump's last full day in office. He began his term at his 2017 inaugural address by saying, quote, "This American carnage stops right here and stops right now," end quote. Well, he is leaving office 2 weeks after his most ardent supporters stormed the Capitol. So far, 93 people have been arrested. How are you reflecting on 4 years of Donald Trump and the damage he and his administration have done, from their failures to address the COVID crisis and the destruction of the administrative state to a broad-scale rollback of decades of environmental protections and the separation of immigrant children from their families, many of whom still have not been reunited? How did we get here? We have been talking about that for 4 years. And where are we going? Do you think this will be a transformative moment? I'll give out the phone number now if you'd like to call and weigh in. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Ann Nelson, an adjunct associate professor at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs and author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Fletcher is a racial justice, labor, and international activist and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Greetings. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have both of you. You know, I want to start off today's show by acknowledging the 400,000 people who have died from COVID. We just hit the 400,000 mark. So many doctors are just really ripping on Trump for his failure to address this pandemic. Dr. Dina Grayson, we've had her on many times. She just tweeted, "Last January, I began warning publicly about the virus, so much needless and avoidable suffering due to Trump's failure to address this pandemic." I also just want to acknowledge the people who have COVID and still have symptoms. I mean, it's just been devastating, the jobs lost, the businesses that have been closed. And I want to start off with you. Just on that issue alone, there's so much reflection to be done.
Absolutely. And I want to acknowledge one of my research colleagues, Dr. Nick Sawyer in Sacramento, who's helped me reveal the hydroxychloroquine hoax that was part of the Trump campaign's efforts, was not only a crime of neglect. There were active measures taken by the administration and its partners in terms of misinformation for the public that cost people's lives.
Mm. Can we read more about that?
Yes, I wrote a piece for the Washington Spectator called Anatomy of Deceit, and it's available online, and I lay it out. And unfortunately, another Californian physician was the point person for spreading the misinformation. So there's a lot to uncover here. And I just, in thinking about the question of reflection, I just was thinking today about how the country needs to properly grieve. It's not just going to be 400,000. We know it's going to be far more before and at the same time, the Trump administration has been responsible for horrible environmental degradation. And every measure that was taken to try to address climate was derailed. And I thought maybe we could do something positive and find a way that people could recognize those they've lost to COVID by supporting the planting of a tree to restore our forests and our arboreal landscapes.
Yeah, it's so, so needed. Thank you for that. And thank you for letting us know about the article you wrote. We will find it and put a link at yourcallradio.org. We should mention that tonight, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will speak at the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool to honor the lives lost to COVID. As far as I know, it'll be the first major memorial that we're going to see. Bill, just on this issue, what are your thoughts? How are you reflecting?
What Trump did was he pulled the picture of Dorian Gray out of the closet and displayed it for the entire world to see. And it was a picture that many people have denied about the United States. This is one of the reasons that there's this infuriating comment that's often made about this is not who we are. No, United States, this is who the United States is. This is a sizable portion of the United States that is prepared and has been prepared to endorse the irrationalist, demonic administration that we've experienced for the last 4 years. And he was very clear. I mean, it was really interesting when you think about his inaugural address, when he used the words America first. You know, some people, I mean, this is representative of the failure of people in the United States to really embrace history and instead to embrace myth. Most people had no idea that this term America first became really popular in the lead up to World War II by a softcore fascist isolationist movement led by Charles Lindbergh. And so when Trump used this in his inaugural address, he was indicating the direction he was going. So there really should have been no surprises.
Well, no surprises. And just even the line, you know, Mexicans are rapists. I hate saying that. I always say I hate saying that on the show. But that's how he also started this campaign. To your point, Bill, about, I mean, when you really think about it, he started with Mexicans are rapists. This American carnage stops right here. I mean, this man is leaving 2 weeks to the day. Well, he'll leave tomorrow, 2 weeks and one day since we saw this insurrection at the White House. And, you know, just this morning, the AP reported that two Army National Guard members have been removed from inauguration duty as part of the security vetting process to ensure that troops do not have ties to extremist groups. Because last night, the Washington Post reported that there was concerns that someone on the inside might turn on politicians. I mean, this is what he's leaving with. It speaks volumes, Bill, about where we are.
For 4 years, actually more than that, there has been a very intense denial in government of the role of right-wing terror and terrorist groups and the level of infiltration in law enforcement and the military. Now, for the most part, the military has been, interestingly, very cautious and very, they've taken a lot of steps against right-wing extremists, much less so with law enforcement authorities. And then in the Obama years, you may remember when the Department of Homeland Security came out with a report that identified the particular danger of right-wing terrorists. The Republicans in Congress went nuts. John Boehner, who was then the speaker, denounced the report, said it was an attack on conservatives, and the Obama administration did what it all too often would do, which was to withdraw the report. Then during the Trump years, as more reports about the growth of right-wing terrorists began to surface, the Trump administration went into active denial and under Attorney General Barr completely flipped the script and tried to identify alleged left-wing terrorist groups, so-called Antifa groups, as well as Muslims as being the main source, when the main source has historically been right-wing terrorists. So I'm not surprised that there were a couple of National Guardsmen that were removed.
What would you add on this, Anne? Even the Military Times put out a piece recently about this, and they found, according to a study that they've done, you know, the military knows it has a problem with domestic terrorists. It says last fall, a Military Times poll found that about one third of all active duty respondents said they saw signs of white supremacist or racist ideology in their ranks. One third.
Well, I look at the situation somewhat from a regional perspective. I grew up in Oklahoma, And if you look at it in terms of American history, you have a disproportionate number of people in the military from the South. That's part of the culture of the military. And in my book, Shadow Network, I talk about how there is just this whole web of fundamentalist radio stations, militaristic organizations that are tied into very conservative religious organizations, a lot of proselytization that's religious tied in with political within the military. One of the most extreme branches happens to be the Air Force, and there's a very conservative fundamentalist psychologist named James Dobson, who has a huge influence in this country through his media empire that is set up in Colorado. And I think you've got a lot of it interchange between the Air Force Academy and Air Force personnel and Dobson's operations. So I agree with what's been said, but I think until you start to address the way these media systems, both broadcast and digital, intersect with the churches and with other institutions like the military, you're not really going to get traction on these problems.
Well, that's the other question that we have been thinking about. How do we address this? Because it's not just Fox and right-wing radio anymore. I mean, you brought up the connections to Christian radio, to religious media, for example. And then you have these conspiracy platforms. Yes, I believe it was yesterday, NPR had just a really sad story about how people are losing their family members to QAnon-like conspiracy theories, where these young people said, my dad gets home at night, he puts on his headphones, he listens to this stuff until he goes to bed. Because of COVID, this young woman said, my mom listens to this stuff 13 hours a day. So we are far beyond just the Foxes and the right-wing radios of the world. There's so much out there that most of us probably have never heard of, right, Anne?
Absolutely. And I really recommend a documentary called The Brainwashing of My Dad, which focuses on the way somebody is taken over by Fox. Mm-hmm. But as you say, there are many different outlets that are repeating the same messages. They're coordinated. And the organization I write about in my book, the Council for National Policy, is a hub for this coordination, among others. So there, people are basically surrounded by this misinformation and this very, they have these pseudo news operations where they have somebody who's supposed to be an anchor person sitting behind a desk with chyrons as though it's a news broadcast, but it's entirely one-sided. And if you watch some of these, which unfortunately I've had to, what they will do is just continually praise Trump and their other icons. And they'll literally call the Democrats demons. They will call them demons. And so it's integrated into this religious worldview. And I think that, again, speaking about the people in the middle of a country where local newspapers have died off at a tremendous rate over the last 20 years, where NPR signals may not go for more than a few miles out of the college town, you have people who are more and more captive to these alternate platforms of information that are pretty much fact-free.
Bill, what would you add on this? I mean, you've seen how this has changed over the last few decades. How do we even begin to address this crisis, especially when it comes to this information echo chamber?
So first, I think we have to recognize that this is fundamentally not new. What's new is the scale, largely because of social media, that when you think about the role that conservative churches and other institutions have had in this country, particularly in rural areas and the South and the Southwest, you're not looking at something that's fundamentally new. You're looking at a different way that these this delusional bubble has unfolded. I mean, just think about what was described in that great film about the Scopes Monkey Trial, Inherit the Wimp. And the fight around truth and around science. We've been down this path for a long time, and we're not getting off this path for a while. So there's a few things that I think need to happen, and they're in different categories. So first, and this may sound strange, right-wing terror itself cannot be tolerated or excused. So in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing, you may remember that the immediate supposition was that it was Muslims or Arabs that had carried out the attack. And everyone was going for a hatchet to go after Muslims and Arabs. When they found out that it was two homegrown white boys, all of a sudden the discussion changed. And there was this discussion about, well, what really motivated these gentlemen? You know, these veterans. I mean, they seemed like they were reasonable people. What could have pushed them over? Now, we know that nothing like that would have happened had the perpetrators been Arab, Muslim, Black, or whatever. And we see proof of that when you look at what happened in 9/11. There was no examination of the family background of any of the terrorists, nor was it necessary. They were terrorists. And so one of the things that we have to understand is that part of defeating the language of the right and the message of the right is taking a strong stand against acts of terror that are perpetrated by them, not explaining them away, not slapping people on the hand, not treating it differently than it would be treated otherwise. So that's one thing. A second thing, and I say this as a trade unionist, is that a lot of what we see really is, should be a wake-up call for the labor movement. And why it is essential to be organizing workers all around this country. One of the things that you see over the years is that even when you have conservative union members, it's more likely that union members are going to have open minds and be voting and acting in a more progressive direction than non-union workers. And so, excuse me, it's part of our job to really get into populations that have been untouched by unions. And we've got to crack into this. The third thing is that in a number of states, there are very progressive rural organizing efforts that are underway. In the Pacific Northwest, particularly, there are these efforts. And I think that these need to be supported.
Well, we'll go over the three issues that you just laid out. That is Bill Fletcher, a racial justice, labor, and international activist, and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. We're also joined today by Ann Nelson, adjunct associate professor at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs, and author of Shadow Network, Media Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. And if you'd like to join us, how are you reflecting on 4 years of Trump and Trumpism, how we got here, where we are today, where we're going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And if you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. And as Bill laid out, there are many, many layers to this. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about all of this, because what was striking about what we're learning now about what happened at the Capitol is you did have a number of, obviously, people who were involved with the military, very organized. They gave off military signals. This is according to people in the military. But then you have people like, for example, the Tampa Bay Times. This story is going around. This woman, Audrey Ann Southard, she is a singer. She teaches singing classes, and she was at the riot yelling, "Tell effing Pelosi we're coming for her. She's a traitor. We're coming for all of you." There have been some stories about how some people who voted for Obama were at the insurrection. So how are you thinking about that? Because there are many layers to these supporters. You cannot just say it's white supremacy. I mean, that's a huge part of it, but it's also more than that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it would be a mistake to fall into this simplistic thinking. I'm even a little annoyed by some of my Twitter counterparts who say, you know, it wasn't a protest, it was a riot. And it's like, well, it could be both things at the same time. Yeah. So we have a whole range of activities. We did have people who just you know, perch themselves at the ellipse and listen to speeches. They existed and they didn't go farther. You had people like the singer that you mentioned that I just published a piece in the Times Literary Supplement calling them the fools on the hill, because there were people who just drifted in and didn't seem to know where they were or what they were doing. But then you had images of these paramilitary outfitted types who were in what is called a snake, going in single file up the stairs. And I have been told by highly reliable sources that there was a plan to kill Nancy Pelosi. And so it's we're far, very, very far away from knowing who was military, who was veteran, who was paramilitary, who was, you know, off-duty police. I mean, you have apparently examples of all of these categories, and it's going to take tremendous investigation to put all the pieces together. I will say that we have to spend serious time looking at how the information systems worked, how they were recruited, how they were indoctrinated, how they were solicited to come to Washington for this event. And we know that organizations within the Council for National Policy were putting out calls and staffing buses. So Charlie Kirk has an organization called Turning Point USA, which is to radicalize conservative college students. And his organization has confirmed that they sent 350 students on January 6th to Washington. So there's a lot to follow up here. And you know, I just want to go back to this idea that unless you go to the root causes of this, then the investigations and the judgments can't be effective in the long term. Let's look at how Trump and his administration approached education. They attacked the teachers' unions. They attacked public education. They encouraged their followers to homeschool their children and to send them to religious schools where they are indoctrinated with fundamentalist education and concepts. And so what they're trying to, and in a lot of cases, creationism, right? This is what Betsy DeVos, as Secretary of Education, was all about. She was the secretary to destroy public education. And you have the same thing going on with fact-based journalism. There was a constant stream of attacks on our best professional journalists and an elevation of these pseudo news organizations like One American Network and Breitbart and so on. They were rewarded while the others were punished. And until we rectify that and win back the trust in these swing states and these radicalized states and say, look, let's find some common ground of recognizing what a fact is, what dialogue is, and discredit the misinformation that's governing your actions. Now, that's going to be necessary to make any long-term progress.
If I could just jump in.
Sure, Bill.
I January 6th, I would argue, was not a riot, wasn't a protest, it was a coup attempt. When you have what we saw of this mob entering Capitol Hill, entering the Capitol, and seeking to capture and threatening to hang people, including Vice President Pence, this was not a riot, except in a very broad and almost useless sense. It was a coup attempt, and it was incited by the President of the United States. And I've been hearing increasingly on the media people referring to it as a riot, which brings to mind kind of disorganized chaos. This was not that. And obviously it could have been more better organized from their standpoint. But I think we have to be very clear about what was going on and the danger that was inherent in this. And we're going to have a continued battle over facts. We have always had those battles in this country. One other point. I think that that Anne is right about, I mean, this wasn't just about race. I've been talking to people. We have to understand that There is a right-wing populist movement in this country that is racist, it is sexist, it is xenophobic, it is irrationalist. There's a number of elements to this movement. And in a peculiar way, it as a result, it allows different points of entry for different segments of the population. Some that are much more misogynist, others that are particularly focused on immigration, et cetera. And it allows them to come in. There's the secular and there's the religious variant there. And we're seeing this as part of this large movement, which is why, A, I don't use the term Trumpist, because this movement preceded Trump. My wife likes to say that Trump was the rattle on the tail of the rattlesnake. It wasn't the snake. We've been seeing the snake poison our system for years, and the snake's going to be around for a while.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. I just wanted to include some information about the military line that we saw. If you saw that video of, it was like, it looked about 5 to 8 guys in military gear. According to the Washington Post, U.S. authorities have leveled the first conspiracy charge against an apparent leader of an extremist group, arresting an alleged oath keeper. Thomas Edward Caldwell, 66, of Virginia, was taken into custody before 7 a.m. on 4 federal accounts, including conspiracy to commit an offense against the U.S. An affidavit said he helped organize a group. It's 8 to 10 individuals, including self-styled Ohio militia members. They wore helmets and military-style gear and were seen moving purposefully toward the Capitol steps and leading the move against police lines. You can find this piece, U.S. Files Conspiracy Charge Against Oath Keeper Leader. We will put a link at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break. We're joined today by Bill Fletcher, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. And Nelson is author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are going to be doing shows about the vaccine rollout in California. There have been many, many problems with it. Just to let you know, if you live in San Francisco, Supervisor Matt Haney is having a hearing tomorrow at 11:30 to get answers to a lot of questions about why people are on hold with Kaiser for 5 hours, what is going on with the main database. So that is tomorrow at 11:30, and then we will be doing a show about vaccines in the coming weeks. Today is Donald Trump's last full day in the White House, and we are reflecting. How are you reflecting on 4 years of Trump? As all of our guests have said, this didn't obviously start with Trump, but if you look at the damage that he and his administration have done over the last 4 years, what really stands out for you? Where are we today? Where are we going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Bill Fletcher, a racial justice, labor, and international activist. His latest book is They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Ann Nelson is an adjunct associate professor at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs and author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. And we have an email from Paul who says, why has the Air Force become a hotbed for right-wing activity? I ask as a Vietnam-era Air Force veteran.
My friends in the military believe that the proximity of the Air Force Academy to James Dobson's powerful operations in Colorado has something to do with it. So, you know, you don't have the same degree of radicalization in every branch of the service, but I think there's a lot more research that will need to be done for this. I should also add that in doing the research for my book, I was quite surprised that, for example, one of Trump's fundamentalist enablers, Robert Jeffress of First Baptist Church in Dallas, who has been very homophobic, Islamophobic, you know, he's very problematic, and he's very much part of this movement. And his radio program has been put on Armed Forces Radio for broadcast to active duty military people. So there are some institutional ties here that need to be reexamined.
What else can you tell us about James Dobson's Family Institute? What else do we need to know about that?
Oh, he is extraordinary. He's a psychologist who actually worked in Southern California, and he founded an organization called Focus on the Family. And it became a fundamentalist psychology and family therapy network that has put out books that have sold tens of millions of copies. And I've had the opportunity to read some of them. They say that women should be submissive to their husbands because the Bible says that the husband should be in command at all times. It says that a parent should always strike their child with a paddle or a switch, not their hand, and that some bruising is desirable. So you have this kind of authoritarian worldview that's then imposed on our national society and our politics. And he founded a group called the Family Research Council, which has become one of the leading lobbying organizations of this movement in Washington. And it was actually entrusted by Trump to write some of the social elements of the Republican national platform in 2016, repeated in 2020. So among these elements is an element on conversion therapy, which, is kind of the psychologically forced conversion of LGBT populations. And it is condemned by legitimate medical authorities, but they're writing it into the Republican national platform based on these movements.
Wow. Well, thank you for that question. Let's go to another listener. Let's hear from Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Good morning and a happy new year.
Happy new year.
Yeah, something seems to be lacking from this conversation, which is Twitter, Facebook, Jack Dorsey, the president, the chief tweet and twit of the land, and the fact that every media outlet has amplified his tweets every day while he still had his account. So I feel like we all ought to be taking some responsibility for what happened on January 6th. Because this has been 4 years of unrelenting propaganda emanating from the White House and from our major news organizations, and some of them I'm only being generous in calling them news organization. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your time, and hope you keep on covering this important story.
Well, thank you for that, Raul. We are putting a show together about social media also in the coming weeks. What are your thoughts on this bill? Some research was conducted by Zignal Labs, and it found that misinformation surrounding the topic of election fraud, quote unquote, dropped by 73% after Trump and others were suspended from social media accounts. 73%.
Well, I'm really glad that the caller raised this point, because I think we have to look back at the origin of the Trump campaign in order to understand how it is that we got into this mess. That Trump was treated by the media as a joke and as an instrument to get ratings and as an, a sort of a, as an odd character. So instead of understanding that Trump was that rattle that I mentioned before, on the rattlesnake, they looked at him as an individual, as a celebrity. And they permitted him to lie, to fabricate, to exaggerate. And it wasn't until quite late that we then started to see these corrections that were being made in mainstream media, that, you know, identifying that the president had lied about something, but they would still repeat it. And so I think that the caller is correct that in addition to social media and the ability of the administration and its allies, and particularly including fascists, to make use of social media, there is a problem in the way that the mainstream media treated the Trump phenomena. And I really think that again, this goes back to this thing I love to say, that in the U.S., we actively oppose history and embrace myth, that instead of understanding that the Trump-led movement was the legacy of something going back at least to 1964, people looked at it in isolation and in that sense underestimated the potential for devastation.
What would you add to that, Anne?
Oh, the caller is raising, I mean, he's right. This is a huge part of this discussion. And I wish we had about 3 hours to talk about it. I'd say three things. One is that all of the social media platforms are profit driven, and that's a problem because they have learned that inflaming emotions it creates a bigger revenue stream than talking sense and facts, because it's just more exciting and people share more things that are alarming or angering. And so we've got a whole uncivil culture that's been developed for profit that needs to be addressed. And Silicon Valley has to kind of take responsibility for not just being a platform that happens to support content, but having an active role in how this society is evolving. The second point I'd make is that Twitter Twitter was the first platform to take Trump off. And I think that they've made a somewhat more active effort to be responsible. I think Facebook has a lot to answer for. And the way that Facebook ads have allowed these organizations to target their prospective recruits. And one thing that you really have to look at, which I go into in the book, is the role of Cambridge Analytica and the data harvesting, which allow them to pinpoint potential voters and approach them with inflammatory material that touches their deepest concerns. And this has been integrated into the religious communities. So the data harvesting has actually taken place within conservative churches, where the pastors have handed over their congregations information, and it's been compared against voter rolls, and then specific voters have been targeted with information and either encouraged to vote or discouraged from casting Democratic votes. So all of this has been documented, and it's a serious problem if we're going to talk about any kind of separation between church and state, because this has been violated.
Discouraged from voting?
Yeah, there's been active voter suppression. Channel 4 in Britain did a very good report in September 2020 about the way that they discouraged Black voters in swing states from voting because they were likely to vote Democrats. That was their record. So they bombarded them with targeted advertising that discouraged them from voting for the presidential candidate, and they actively depressed those votes by enough of a difference in states like Wisconsin and Michigan to make the difference in the Electoral College.
And this happened in some cases through churches?
In some cases, especially in terms of boosting Republican votes, right. This happened through churches. But in the same church, if they found on their voter roll that somebody in the church always voted Democrat, they would not take the same efforts to get them to the polls that they would for the likely Republican voters. So there's a documentary called People You May Know on Amazon right now that goes into this in detail.
Thank you for that. People You May Know. Yeah, you're right. We need 2 more hours, but I want to ask you, Bill, since you focus on unions and labor, I was just looking at the vote count. So again, Hillary Clinton got almost 3 million more votes than Trump. He got 62.9 million. This time around, he got even more, 74 million. And In These Times had a piece in December, the union members who voted for Trump have to be organized, not ignored. What are your thoughts about this, Bill? Because he made these promises in coal country. He made promises to deal with the opioid crisis, and he didn't deliver at all to average workers. In this piece, Mandy Isser points out that of the 74 million people who voted for Trump, almost a third come from households making under $50,000. So what are your thoughts on this, especially when we're talking about working people?
So several points. One is that within the trade union movement, somewhere between 25 and 30% of union members regularly vote Republican. And I say that because there's often a supposition in liberal and progressive circles about how overwhelmingly progressive union members are. And while the vast majority are, there's a significant minority that isn't. Now, in 2016 and 2020, you had, they estimate about 40% of union households voted for Trump. And I think this should tell us a lot. One is that despite what many union people would like to believe about the interest that workers should identify with, the reality is that many of our members have other identities and conflicting identities and priorities. And this is where the issue of race and gender becomes incredibly important. The failure of the union movement to consistently tackle the issues of racism and sexism, not to mention xenophobia, have come back to haunt us. Case in point. The union movement has focused for years on free trade agreements and how dangerous they are. And it's true, they are. And they're very they're antithetical to the interests of workers. But the union movement has tended to focus on why they are dangerous to U.S. workers, as opposed to pointing out that they're dangerous to workers across this planet. So when you look at NAFTA, it wasn't just U.S. workers that suffered. Mexican workers and farmers suffered in vast numbers, which helps to explain the spike in migration to the United States after 1994. But much of the union movement didn't talk about that. So then along comes Trump. And what does he talk about? Free trade agreements. And so you have many of our members that would say, well, wait a minute, he's saying the same thing that you guys were saying. Well, he wasn't quite, but I understand why people would draw those conclusions. So we're reaping the results of trying to narrow our approach to workers. The other thing that we have to deal with is that one of the central themes of Trump and the right-wing populist movement is essentially the reestablishment of the white republic. And when you have the American dream collapsing for millions and millions of white people, it is much easier to believe that the source of that are migrants, African Americans, other domestic peoples of color, women in some cases, LGBTQ in others, right? Other nations are beating up on the United States allegedly, rather than understanding, no, my friend, the system is crushing you.
It just speaks to the desperate need for a real economic agenda moving forward. Even before COVID, obviously, people were struggling, but now it just hits people in the face. What are your thoughts about this bill? Because, you know, people are already talking about 2022 and 2024, that the Biden administration, obviously with pressure from below, but it really needs to deliver for working people.
It does, but it's more than economics. You know, one thing I remind my friends is that the white migration away from the Democratic Party did not start in the 1970s in the aftermath of the recession of the early 70s. It started just as Lyndon Johnson predicted, almost immediately after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So it wasn't driven by economics. Now, economics dovetailed with it at a certain point, and particularly when the Democratic Party establishment started, like under Bill Clinton, embracing neoliberal economics or capitalist fundamentalism, this was something that absolutely discouraged workers. There's no question about it. So it's what we have to realize is that, yes, there needs to be a clear economic populist message, but there needs to be just as clear a message on race and gender that does not lead people to think that we can all start singing kumbaya by just talking about those things that supposedly unite us without understanding that if we don't tackle race and gender, we're never going to be united.
Hmm. Anne, what would you add?
Well, sometimes I listen, you know, to the Republicans and then I listen to the Democrats. And when I look at the way they communicate, even if the Republicans are communicating a misguided false message, it's often in language that's very easy to grasp and is rousing. A lot of times you have the Hillary Clinton problem, which is policy speak. And for other people engaged with policy, it's great because it's very technical. But I think it loses a lot of the public. So I think that there has to be a kind of overhaul in the way that we talk to different parts of the country. If you look at the 2020 election, Biden won by 7 million popular votes, a record number. But let us not forget that he could have lost the Electoral College by only 45,000 votes in three states. And that 45,000 is very, very little. And these three states were Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia, right? And these are not states that are on the front pages all the time. What I'm saying is that these swing states have populations that are outside the coastal media systems. And they're thinking about different issues. They have different concerns. I think that the voters who turn out at the highest levels, who, they happen to be older and white, and a lot of them are suburban and rural, and they feel as though the national conversation is not talking to them, is not listening to them, is not engaging them. And that's why they're such easy marks for some of these propagandists, because they are going after them, targeting them in very specific language, and also harvesting their data to see what their hot button issues are. And they also respond to their concerns about whatever the Democrats are doing and sow alarm about nonsense, like, you know, Biden and Harris want to turn the United States into Venezuela. You know, like, what kind of an idea is that? You know, it's crazy talk. But they become susceptible to it because of these ways of articulating this misinformation and the avenues through which they convey it. So again, I think that you need to go back to information systems and reconnect the arteries of this country so that we're actually talking to each other instead of posited against each other and talking past each other.
Well, and also, Bill,
we'll just jump in.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Just that, in addition to what Ann said, the Republicans talk in stories. Democrats and many progressives talk in facts. And what we have to understand is that we have to create stories based on the truth. That people respond when they hear stories. They want to know, how does their situation fit in with other things? So what conspiracy theories and right-wing garbage does is that it creates a world in which people can figure out fairly easily where they fit in. Now, it may be completely delusional, but they're not just throwing facts at people. They're saying, this is the way that the world operates, and this is why you're miserable. And so when Ann says this thing about, like, Hillary Clinton and policy speak, it's like, absolutely. It's not just what do you stand for, Secretary Clinton? It is, what's the story? What's the storyline about why workers, working people, are getting screwed every day in this country? Now, there's some positive examples of doing it the right way. Bernie Sanders has done it. Jim Hightower was just brilliant at doing this. Mm-hmm. And there are others, but there's still this thing that all we have to do is just throw the facts out and let the facts speak for themselves.
Right.
I absolutely agree with Bill on this.
Can we have about a minute left, Anne? Yes.
And what I'll just say it really quickly. What people want to hear are stories in which they are the heroes. And that is some political messaging that the Democrats need to master.
Mm. Yes.
We're almost out of time. Final thoughts from both of you. Do you think this is a transformative moment, Bill?
Absolutely. And I remain optimistic, but I am optimistic because what I see is that there has always been a very core 25-30% of the electorate that has been, frankly, very evil. But most of the electorate is not. They may be confused. They may have differences of opinion. We can have differences of opinion. But most of the electorate isn't evil. So I am quite optimistic that we basically are on the verge of creating a new majority. But the Biden-Harris administration and Democrats as a whole are going to have to move very quickly and with great audacity.
What about you, Anne? Do you think this is a transformative moment?
I hope so. As I write history, I see that great crises can create great spurts of creativity. And that's what we saw with the New Deal. It couldn't have happened without the Depression. And we benefited from Social Security and all of these other areas. So here we have COVID, we have an economic collapse, we've got a collapse of political confidence, and we've got a Biden administration and a barely Democratic Senate. I think the question is whether the citizenry will get behind it and overcome divisiveness and find a way to find common ground and common good with some energy and get past this culture of infighting and attacking each other that we've lived in for so long. And, you know, it's the question is like, do you have faith in human nature? And the answer is some days.
Right, some days. Ann Nelson is an adjunct associate professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. Ann, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Fletcher is a racial justice, labor, and international activist and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can find more about Ann and Bill's books and their work at yourcallradio.org, where you can also listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.